accession number 18776, Real 4.
Colonel Stuckey, Real 4. Now, we're losing time now, Colonel, so we have to jump ahead to the Chindits. Can you tell me how you became a Chindit, please?
Yes, I think I probably can. It's, I suppose you could say it's by accident, in that the 81st West African Division sailed for India in September of 1943, destined for Bombay, and the last brigade to land was in fact the 3rd Nigerian Brigade, my brigade, and when we arrived in Bombay, expecting to go off down to join our parent division, the 81st Division, in the Caledon Valley, we were told that other plans were afoot. And what it amounted to was that we had been selected by General Wingate to join his force because he was looking for another brigade. It appears that he liked the British, he liked the Gurkha, but he wasn't so keen on the Indian troops for whatever reason. And when he learnt that Nigerian brigade was in fact landing, he said, well, I quite like that brigade. And because he had enormous power with the politicians, everyone from Roosevelt, Churchill downwards, perhaps, there was acquiescence. It was agreed that we would be, as it were, diverted. So that instead of going off down to the Caledon to join our parent division, we suddenly found ourselves going up to central provinces to join up with what was known as the Chindit force. This was all very new to us. Anyhow, we set off in the usual troop train from Bombay, and after a day and a half, I think it was, in the train, we arrived in, I think it must have been Sorgar, somewhere near there, Jhansi, on the Betwa River, and we were given our instructions and told that we had to, as it were, reorientate ourselves totally, forget all we knew and really about normal conventional organization. Each battalion was to reorganize into two columns, each commanded by either the commanding officer or the second in command. We were to change our internal organization totally, and we were to take on board something like 40 mules as for pack purposes, and half a dozen ponies for casualty evacuation purposes, and we were to learn a totally new philosophy of battle, should we say, which was known as long-range penetration. We were part of the long-range penetration group under General Wingate, known locally as the Chindits.
Which West African units went into the Chindits under with you?
Yes, we were, which one?
What number was it?
Well, the 3rd West African Brigade, 3rd Nigerian Brigade, sorry. 3rd Nigerian Brigade, you had three brigades, of course, as with any division, and we were the total all Nigerian battalion, three Nigerian battalions, brigade headquarters and so on, all Nigeria, in fact.
Which were you in yourself?
I was the 12th Nigerian Regiment. So in our brigade, we had the 7th Battalion, the 6th Battalion, the 7th Battalion, and the 12th Battalion.
And what column of the Chindits did you become?
You were allowed to choose your own column numbers, and they tended to be based on the commanding officer's regiment in the British Army and its seniority. And because my colonel was Colonel Pat Hughes of the Oxen Bucks Light Infantry, which was also the 43rd of foot, he said, right, well, my column is going to be called number 43. Second in command, Skip Taylor, you can call your battalion, your column, number 12, i.e., because it was 12th Nigerian Regiment, 12th Battalion. So that's how that evolved. So we set about this business of intensive training, indoctrination, reading up the many Wingate treatises that had been pushed out, and he was quite an assiduous scribe, as Wingett. He pushed out a lot of doctrinal stuff on paper, which was extremely well-researched, well-written, quite erudite in some ways, but extremely practical too, all based, of course, on his experiences on the first Wingett expedition in 1943, where they were really on something of a learning curve. And, of course, he was, in fact, trying to prove his philosophy, which was, in a nutshell, I suppose, that long-range penetration efforts deep into the belly of the enemy, you might say, was much more effective than sparring in a more conventional way on the front line. And if you could hit the enemy good, deep, good, hard, and proper, and really deep, and cut his lines of communication, where he was weak anyway, you would be doing untold good, and at a disproportionate rate to your own effort and losses. And of course, that there was much in this. But in order to sustain any kind of activity like this behind the column, behind the Japanese line, and we were something like 200 miles behind our own front line, don't forget, you needed several things to help you. Apart from a totally new philosophy of action, you also needed supply, and therefore you had to depend on the air. And in fact, was able to recruit enormous support, mainly from the Americans, for air supply, with the Dakota, dropping of supplies, in short, which was not new, but nevertheless was enormously developed as a technique, I think, with the Chindits. Then, of course, because you hadn't got any heavy artillery, any heavy weapons, you had to have some alternative, and the alternative was thought to be the direct airstrike, or the air support, if you like, which either strike or bomber aircraft coming in to help you, as directed by you, on the ground, within sight of the target. So you'll be acting in the sense of a forward observation post, FOO, bringing in the fire and directing it. And that's why, of course, each column, a bit of a joke, but each column had a Royal Air Force officer with it. And what happened, as an aside, was that the RAF put out in their routine orders that volunteers were required for service, operational service in Burma. So a lot of chaps from England put in their names, thinking they were onto something really good and probably going on to the latest type of fighter aircraft or something, service in the Far East, until their shock and horror, when they got out there, they found it was nothing like that at all. They were actually going to be with the PBI, the infantry, marching through the jungle, and in fact their role was to direct the fire from above, so that when the RAF or the American bombers and strike aircraft came over, because they knew the sort of language the pilot was using, they were able to talk the pilots in to the target. And in fact, it all worked out very well, because once the RAF had got over the initial shock, they became very much part of the team, and they did wonderful work. So we were very glad to have them. Invaluable people they were. But we had to master. So Wingett's philosophy really was that you move about deep in the heart of the enemy territory, you're resupplied by the air, so you have total mobility, you can say when and what you want and where you want it, and at the same time, if you want a really heavy strike, you can do so by using your air. And then you've got good wireless communications, of course, was the third prong, you might say, of the equation, and good communication had to be vital, and I mean vital, because without that communication ability, of course, you will get nowhere. So we had some very good wireless sets. We had an RAF set, for instance, which was very high-powered, which operated back to base, and which was used to demand what resupply you wanted and what you wanted in your resupply. And then, of course, it was also used in the operational sense to bring in direct airstrikes, as in where you wanted it, on the targets that you had spotted, recognized. So we went about all this, and we went through a lot of experimental stuff. We trained like mad, And we were out day and night in the central provinces, and we never saw a town or city or bright lights or anything like that. We were hard at it until that was right through the Christmas period. We hardly had a break for Christmas, 1943. And early 44, we were warned that we would be shortly moving up into Burma via Assam. And in due course, when we'd completed our trials, and there were some very interesting trials done, I should say, experimentally, like trying to lift a glider off the ground, for instance, with trailing behind a Dakota, a huge hook. And the idea was that you could use the initial onslaught of the initial move in of the Chindits was to be by 16 Brigade under Brigadier Bernard Ferguson. And then the second wave would be by glider borne, where it wasn't possible to put down any wheeled aircraft, glider borne aircraft, which were put down and enable the troops who got out to clear the paddy buns away from the paddy, which had been selected as the likely area. And then, having cleared the paddy buns, then the aircraft would come in behind them. So we had a lot of training in gliders, and some experiments were carried out, like trying to hook up gliders on the ground, the idea being that once they'd landed, we could go back and pick them up and hook up and take them back into and use them a second time round. Anyhow, it was all a bit of a joke because it didn't really work. But things like that. I remember watching one of these demonstrations when Mountbatten and Wingate were standing quite near. Mountbatten had come down especially to see this, and it was supposed to be done at night. So you had the American Wacko glider on the ground with its trailing rope onto what looked like a rugger post. And the idea was that the Dakota would swoop down and it would have a trailing wire, and the two would hook up and the glider would be snatched, as it were, off the ground. Well, this was at night, and all the poor old Dakota pilot had to see was this little sort of winking light down below. And I think he did about four rounds before he managed to get it to work, and eventually he did pick it up and sort of allowed cheers all round. But I think it was decided soon after that it wasn't really a very practical way of going about it. Another thing we did, an experiment, which also caused some amusement, was the idea that instead of using, not only using mules as pack animals, but also the bullock was quite a good pack animal. And what's more, the bullock might be rather better to eat when it had done its bit. And the time came, so we experimented with dropping bullocks, replacement bullocks, as it were, on parachutes. And we witnessed some of this going on these trials, but it didn't really work for the simple reason that the poor old bullocks, there they had, they were fairly well supported by parachute, two or three parachutes, of course, big ones. They tended to break the odd ankle on landing, and so that meant they were hors de combat straight away. So the conclusion was that this was really a non-starter. But well, lots of little things like this were going on, and we had distraction warfare, of course, going on, dropping pyrotechnics about to distract the enemy, all these things. A lot of stuff which was really very forward-thinking at the time, experimental. Some of it worked, some of it didn't. We had a Lieutenant Colonel Peter Fleming, a well-known author, who in fact was in charge of our sort of distraction force. And he was the one who invented all these pyrotechnics, these bangs and crackers and so on. And the idea was that you would, and Dakota would fly over a certain area and drop this little lot onto the ground, and they'd be on a timed fuses, so that 3 or 4 hours later, suddenly a mock battle would start up. There'd be lots of bangs going on, and the enemy would wonder what it was all about and would come across to have a look, and then you would ambush them. I'm not sure whether this ever really was used in practice, but it was one of the many bright ideas that were dreamed up. And Peter Fleming, because he was a celebrated author, was, I think, and considered to be a bit of a kingpin on deception. I think he was the one who led all this. But so we went through a very exciting period, really, of trying out all these new techniques, which were very ably and aptly written up by Wingate in his training memoranda, he called it. And we had training memoranda number 1, number 2, number 3, up to about number 12, each training memoranda covering a different aspect of what you did, how you harboured at night, what you did on the line of march, what you did if you were ambushed, and so on. And it was extremely good, and I hope those memoranda are on record, because they deserve to be. Come February, March, beginning of February, we started our move from the central provinces across India. And because we were a troop train, for some reason we had a rather low priority. And so you wouldn't believe it, but it took a week in a troop train to get from the central provinces across India via Calcutta and up into Assam, partly on a river, I think we did, the riverboat. But anyway, it took us a whole week on board. And it was pretty heavy going, because you stopped the train occasionally, and if you wanted to cook up some rice or something like that for the troops, you took down your dixies to the engine. The engine driver would then cooperate and discharge boiling hot water from the engine, and that would help you cook your rice. In no time you had a meal, all by the side of the track. This would go on for about an hour, the main meal of the day, and your troops were duly fed, and you'd get back in again and proceed. But it was terribly hot, and when we got going through Calcutta, it was particularly unpleasant, I remember. So we seemed to take ages being hived off into sidings and so on, and sun was really beating down. It was very unpleasant from that point of view. However, when the time came, we got up into Assam, and then we got near a place called, I think it was Lalagat, which was where we were intended to take off. And our lot was to fly in to one of the strongholds called Aberdeen, which it was then called. And we did a bit of reorganization up there, practice of loading aircraft and that type of thing, technical training to do with loading, getting our mules on board and all this. It was quite a performance, I might tell you, because one thing mules are not trained to do is to go up a ramp and get in a Dakota aircraft without asking a few questions first as to what it's all about. So the technique of getting a mule on board was quite complicated, but one was in fact evolved and did work in the end. It was quite a performance. And of course, little things came into it. Like, for instance, if you're going to have mules on board, the first thing you had to do was to, make good with mattresses and goodness knows what. The sides of your aircraft, the fuselage, had to be protected, so that if the mule got a bit upset or barbary and started kicking out, he didn't kick a hole through the side of the aircraft, which might have been, although we weren't flying too high, so we might not have had a great problem over the pressurization or anything like that, but even so, it could have been quite dangerous. So all these sort of little things, which were brand new to us, had to be taken into account. And going back, talking of mules again, you see, going back onto our training on the Baitor River, what happens if you come to the Irrawaddy, and you have to cross Irrawaddy, which is about half a mile wide, and how are you going to get your mules over? And training a mule to swim across a widish river when he can't see the far bank and getting him to keep going is not exactly an easy matter at all. So we practiced this like mad, and again we developed various techniques which on the whole tended to work. But we did find that once you got the leader, if you had a good leader among your mules, you got your leader pointing in the right direction and swimming, and the other mules would tend to swim on behind him, and that was fine. Occasionally you'd find that for some reason something would go wrong and the leader would change his mind, decide he'd had enough and then turn around and go back again. So it was all a bit of a laugh, but it was new, it was exciting, and it was really a challenge, I suppose you would say, to all of us. And we felt that we were in something which was completely new. And of course, we're all, I suppose, somewhat imbued with Wingate's personality, persona, charisma, and whatever, which was not inconsiderable. He would come round. We didn't see much of him. He would come round sometimes in Mountbatten, sometimes not. He'd be driving the jeep. Mountbatten would be sitting beside him, only two in the vehicle. an American jeep, and they would have a quick chat. And when my baton came, I remember he was a great a man for the common touch, because all the officers were lined up, and then the NCO, British NCOs were lined up, and Mountbatten, going down the line, was introduced by the commanding officer to each one. This is Major so-and-so, this is Captain somebody else. And Mountbatten was electric in his performance, because every time he stopped, he sort of was stopped by every other man, roughly speaking, every other officer. And he would say, "Well, now, Captain Garner, where do you come from?" I come from Sutherland. And he would say, "Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting. I've got an aunt there." And then he'd move on to the next one. "And where do you come from?" You see, "And I come from Plymouth." "Oh, Plymouth, I know it well. I was stationed there." And every time he spoke to somebody, he had something in common. Well, he was making it up as he went along, I don't know, but everybody believed it. So he had a great sort of rapport, I think, with people, did Mountbatten, and he was very impressive in that role. Wingett was impressive as a personality, in the sense that he would come round, gather round me, and give us a quick pep talk. And then, of course, he had this funny thing of the alarm clock in the pocket, which you've probably heard of many times. And he used to set himself, say, "Right, I'll give that about 10 minutes. So he would get up on his, stand on his jeep, officers gathering round him, NCOs, British NCOs in our case, and give us a quick pep talk and say, "You know, how are things going? Want to help, let me know, but don't forget, we're in it. I don't want any doubts. Anyone any doubts about what he's doing? He's in doubt, now's the time to say so." And no messing about, sort of thing. So you knew where you stood. And then the alarm clock would go off in his pocket, so he'd take his, pull out this alarm, so put it back, and time waits for no man. Let's get on. So it was a well-known drill. And So we had all this exciting, innovative training, and then we moved on, as I say, up into Assam, and with a bit of practice about getting emplaning and so on, the technique of getting animals and equipment and kit, and how to do it, how to stow it, how to make it safe on an aircraft. And the air regulations are quite strict, of course, about, for instance, the simple matter of loading ammunition. Well, you don't just bung ammunition in and hope for the best. You have to put it in and strap it down and make certain it doesn't move and all that. So there's a certain amount of technique required, and we had to master all this in a matter of days. We had RAF support, but we also had the major part of the air effort was in fact American, because what Wingett had managed to achieve by his visits back to he was talking to Churchill and talking to Roosevelt, he managed to sell the idea of the Shindit force in a big way, and Churchill was a man of vision and imagination, so it rather caught his
imagination,
you see, and he liked it, and so he backed it, and he and Roosevelt quite liked what he heard too. So we had this enormous American effort, which was a bonus to anything we might otherwise have had. It wouldn't have been in India at all. Wouldn't have been in that theatre had it not been. So there was a certain amount of jealousy in GHQ Delhi on the part of the other forces, who sort of, you know, all this is going to this lot. We don't particularly care for it. But the fact is, it wouldn't have been there anyway if it hadn't been for Wingett's influence. So there it was. But I only mention the Americans because, of course, one of the glider pilots was Jackie Coogan, who was the well-known American actor pre-war and post-war, for that matter, Jackie Coogan. And he was there. And he was married to Betty Grable, also a famous American actress. And he would be a bit of a diversion two or three nights. The Americans, of course, always looking after their comforts. They'd rigged up a bit of a cine show, open-air screen cinema, and they were putting on one or two sort of pre-war American films, and the cameraman was in fact Jackie Coogan himself. And I remember that we were watching a film, and there were a few ribald comments from the troops, you know, "What's it like being married to Betty Grable, Jackie?" That sort of stuff. So within a matter of days we were told off where we were to report to the airstrip, airfield, and we were told that we were going off that night. And I think we were due to go off at about 8 o'clock, but the airman, who was American, didn't turn up. And we wouldn't quite know what was happening. We were all sort of about our little party. I was with the commanding officer and about half a dozen of us, And we were wondering what was going to happen next. Anyhow, nothing happened, and we just waited and waited. Some of us went to sleep. And then at about just after midnight, the American pilot arrived and made a few apologies and said something about had a bit of a party. So we thought, oh my God, what's he going to be like when he gets in the pilot's seat? Anyhow, nothing we could do about it. But he was all right, it must have been, because he flew us in. And so we just sort of got in, got strapped in, and waited, took off. That was fine. Then we were in the air for, I suppose, a couple of hours. And then we began to get the message that we were circling. And so I remember looking out of the cabin, and I could just see what looked like a miles away, a sort of little lights down below. And so I thought, oh, I suppose this is it. We continued to circle lower and lower and lower, and the lights got more apparent, bigger. And eventually, we did our final run. We came into land, and we landed at a place called Aberdeen, which was a stronghold, which was opened up by 16 Brigade, Brigadier Ferguson, shortly before.
What was it like?
Well, it was just a paddy field that had been cleared by 16 Brigade, who'd marched in, don't forget, and that was one of their tasks. They cleared it. It was an amazing place, really, in the sense that each end of this paddy field, which is only about 1,200 yards long, were quite considerable features, hills, and so that the pilot had to make his judgment very carefully about bringing the aircraft in to land. And if he got it slightly wrong, if he didn't land, as it were, as near as possible one end, then he'd run out of runway, the other end, and he'd go into the hill and have a crash. And equally, of course, if he landed too short the other end, he'd hit the hill the wrong end. So it was altogether a pretty hazardous business. And looking back on it, I don't think no airman in his right mind would have dreamed today of going into any landing ground with that sort of hazard each end. And when you add to the fact that this is being done in the dark, and that all they have are these little pilot lights depicting the runway, the skill of these American pilots was enormous. And also, I think one tends to forget that in many cases, they weren't professional pilots at all. If you got talking to some of these guys, you would say, well, you know, what are you doing? Are you in the air? Oh, no, I'm a school teacher. I'm an architect. I'm a doctor. They were professional people doing all sorts of different professions and trades and what have you, who just volunteered for the American Air Force, learnt to fly an aircraft, found themselves in Dakotas, and were getting on with the job with amazing expertise. And I have great admiration for the Americans and the way they did that, without regard, really, for their own safety. And so there we were in Aberdeen, wondering what to do, and we were there. We got in at about, I suppose, about 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, and we stayed.